This is Retronics After Hours.
Congratulations for landing on Rack Addicts After Hours, a music and technology podcast. It's time for episode 149, so sit back in your bubbly bath and listen to myself, Ben, Pete, and Ollie is here once more, but in significantly higher quality and with less clinks and pub noises, because that was your first one. It was in the pub, wasn't it?
It was in the pub. It was in the garden of the pub. And you say a higher quality version of Ollie if you invited my older brother in.
Didn't know there was an option.
No.
We need him.
I shouldn't have said that.
Anyway, we're away again, and we're going to... Yes, you're going to be the first victim. What have you been doing this week, or the past week, or the past month, because I can't remember when you were last here. Fill us in.
I moved house and put on some weight, changed employer, and made ceviche.
Not much then. Pete, I'm joking. We must find out. New job. Exciting stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very, very good speaker manufacturer. Yes, I did get a new job, and for Martin Audio, fine purveyors of live PA sound, and... overall, top chaps.
Ceviche. I've always pronounced it as ceviche in my head, but I don't even know what is it.
It's got a B in it.
It does?
Yeah. I've not got the greatest amount of lexia. In fact, I've got a dyslexia. it's basically some form of flesh cooked in acid. Like a mild, you're trying to get rid of a body, but you actually want to eat the body, but the body not kill you. Prawns are a nice, easy thing to ceviche.
That's because making it more appetizing. Great.
Yeah, that's
like prawns.
It. That's it. And generally, the acid is citrus. So chili and limes are the classic. You can do it in pineapple, I believe. But you essentially let the acid sort of cook through. In a way, it cures the meat. Maybe I'm getting too technical for my own good here because I might not be spitting absolute facts. But it's very, very lively and you feel cultured. It's nice and light. And it's a real slap around the taste buds.
Slap around the taste buds, indeed. Are you a sushi kind of guy as well? Because it's not 100% cooked, is it? Is it just acid kind of curing? Is it then, do you fry something? What's the situation?
No, it's like a meat salad. I'm not particularly a sushi guy myself. It tends to be a little, I don't know, dry. And sushi is a bit like Formula One. I've got no problem with it in of itself, but people who really, really like it put me off it a bit. It's mostly the fan base, not necessarily the activity itself. You know, sushi's fine, but the amount of people who just go, oh, sushi's going to change your life. You're going to look amazing. You're going to be happier. You're going to leave your girlfriend. I don't really buy into that with sushi or Formula One.
Got it. So ceviche, a mouth party.
It is a bit of a raw mouth party. Yes.
Wonderful.
Coming soon to BBC 12.
Pete, you got to follow that one up.
I'm not sure how I can, really.
Impossible.
Anyway, you might have noticed there's a little bit more space around the Rack Addicts Towers.
Just a smidge.
And hence, as soon as there was space, I was able to indulge in the virtual reality, which I haven't done for quite some time. So I've been getting into that. I've been checking out the metaverse.
Ooh.
Where...
There's topic du jour.
Mr. Zuckerberg has thrown all the cash.
Yep.
And yes, I'm not really sure.
Did it seem expensive?
No. Well, I've experienced those type of meta environments before, but this is the metaverse world or the their own incarnation of it. I did go to a Billie Eilish concert.
Cool.
For a brief moment, I realized very shortly it wasn't really for my demographic when I was there.
That's fair enough.
And then I've been playing lots of Death Unchained again. Got back into
that. Oh, is that the archery one?
Yes.
Yeah,
so
that was good fun.
I'm still maintaining my position. I'm in the top 10% in the world.
Oh, yeah. I didn't realise. Brilliant.
And I had some friends over and tried to introduce them to it as well. Mm. And you realise there is quite a learning curve to get this sort of bow skills up to get to the point where you can actually get round some of the obstacles and courses and so forth.
Any VR sickness, or were they all fine?
Well, I tend to steer away from all the games that are where there's any chance that it's going to make you feel any sort of nausea, any motion sickness. So the Death Unchained that I mentioned earlier is very much one-to-one movements.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And obviously for musical things, to avoid nausea, you don't go and see Coldplay concerts. That's a zinger, that's too easy. My apologies.
Yeah, so lots of VR, lots of sort of prepping and getting ready. Going on further from last week when I said I hadn't got the various modules that I was planning to get, I rushed out and got them all after when I was editing the podcast, going thinking, you know, I really should sort that out, as I said I was going to do it, and I promised myself I was going to do it. So I have the Nobula Polycinematic
Wonderful.
In the Dark Edition, and I also have the Endorphin's Ghost, which Excellent. Is now in the Scarab.
What did you swap it out for? Was it the Mimeophone?
Yes.
Yeah, got it.
So it's sort of interesting. I've just got to, again, with a lot of effects processes, you know, you've got to find the right sort of instruments to put through them to make them sort of come to their full functionality, or to really appreciate what they can do for you.
Nice one. Can we expect a bit of an update on how the Polycinematic goes next week?
When it gets installed, hopefully, yes.
Is that going in the Scarab as well?
Well, I've got a bit
of a
space issue, so I'm pulling stuff out, but as I've said in previous podcasts, I'm getting very close to having to build a second Scarab case, and then that'll encourage me to buy more modules, so it's a bit of a cyclical thing, isn't it?
Oh, here's an idea. You could build a second half of the Scarab that's kind of the same depth as you've got the modules in, so but it will attach to the hinges in the same way.
Oh, I know, so what you mean. So it's double-sided, yeah.
Probably wouldn't be able to close it patched, but that way you could potentially put it on an amp stand in a way like it is now, that it's, you know, a full vertical.
Possibly. The trouble
12 view.
The trouble with doing that is that when you build these boxes, you have to build them as a closed box.
And then cut them in half.
And then cut them in half so that the actual two sides match.
You could do that so you can have either of them as individual cases and then combine them. Some weird magical modular transformer.
Possibly.
Or become a magical nanny like Mary Poppins. It worked for her.
Yeah, okay. Oh, what are you talking about? The magical bag? Of many things.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You could have the magical scarab of many silly worded audio brand bits of kit.
Yes, quite so, definitely. You have like a kind of a bottomless pit. You just throw them in there and they just keep going, disappearing into the abyss.
Only the finest technical advice given by the guests on Rack Addicts, episode 149.
I'm actually going to take a quick aside into the end of the synth news I had planned for today, because you've got the Endorphin's Ghost over there.
Yes.
A signature model. I would like from both of you, please, to let me know about a piece of signature gear that you think is great, and if you can, one that you think is the worst thing ever to have graced this good earth. And while you're chewing on that, I'm going to tell you about a couple of other signature-related things that have surfaced in the modular world. So, another one from Andrew Huang is on the Kickstarter now. He has collaborated with MyVaults, makers of the Ripcord, that USB to DC jack adapter thing that's quite cool. We have light-up patch cables here. Not the light-up patch cables of yesteryear, which are just on-off brightness, maybe. These are bi-colour and brightness-able. It's pretty cool. So they have lots of different options, but you'll have, the brighter it is, the higher the voltage, and each of them will do one colour for negative voltage, one for positive. Let me just find out which one's which, because I can't remember off the top of my head. So you have blue and red, or green and red are your options, and there's various colours of cables, lengths, and other packages. It's on Kickstarter. They are called Halo, MyVaults and Andrew Huang. That's pretty cool idea. And another one helping you to visualise voltages in your rack is from Molten Modular and Bafaco, our favourite people in the modular world who like to collaborate. This one is called the Molten Motion Meter. Is a three-channel attenuator, but you have a fantastic ring of LEDs around each knob, rather like Euclidean circles.
Yes,
by VPME.de, that one. So you have, again, two colours for positive and negative and brightness, I think. Oh, wait, no, because it's a circle. It's how much of the circle is sort of filled for how high the voltage is. But it also does audio, and it's pretty cool. Just another way of visualising stuff in your rack. Should be available soon. Signature gear. Any thoughts?
signature gear. Well, I must apologise to some of you regular listeners because I'm afraid I'm going to have to go into the world of strings.
I'm going to join you in the world of strings, actually.
Nice.
Yes.
These are magnetic strings. I mean, the best one's a difficult one to say, I guess, because for something to be a good signature in my mind, it needs to be quite unique, but have an aspect to it that's going to appeal to a lot of people at the same time, which is a difficult one. The only thing that I can think of products that works, fulfills that, that brings in a nice originality that isn't obviously the Les Paul from the 50s. is probably Johnny Marr's Jaguar.
Tell me about that. I know nothing.
Well, I don't want to go too far into it because if you're not into offset guitars, it's going to be an absolute gravel of a listen for me to go through this. But put plain and simply, everything that you think you don't like Jaguars for, the Johnny Marr Jaguar fixes, and it is one of the finest factory-made Fender instruments they produce and have done for a while. It's got a lovely nitro finish on it. The neck is really good. They're really nice and consistent instruments in the experience I've had with them. They sound fantastic, and lots of user-unfriendly features in classic Jaguars are completely taken away for this
Johnny. For example, because I wouldn't know what the bad ones were in the first place.
Examples being the bridge, which always brought your intonation out of tune and kept sinking into the body. That's completely fixed. A trem arm that kept flopping and dangling down by the controls or hitting your jack input. That's fixed, so it goes somewhere where it stays. It doesn't have the switches that turn themselves off when you're actually playing guitar.
Oh, yeah.
It's got the high-pass filters. The switches are actually shallower, so you don't accidentally turn that on by purpose. And one of them's actually flipped over to one side so that it's impossible to hit it on by accident. Mm-hmm. It also gives you the tonal options of your two Jaguar pickups in series as a humbucker. So you can do lots of dark sounds with a Jaguar.
I've never heard of having just like high pass switches in a guitar before, because I've ignored every single offset guitar that's ever existed.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough. I mean, most of the world did. But yeah, the Jaguar was a fiercely bright guitar anyway. And then they stuck with comb filters, and then they stuck a high pass filter on it because amps weren't loud enough in 1962 when it
just
was invented.
To cut through, right.
Exactly. And these days, with the modern equipment we've got, it can be awful. but the Johnny Marr Jaguar does get through all of that. Plus, it's a really, really nice thing to have. It was much easier for me to come up with the worst piece of
wonderful
of signature
laid
gear
on me,
which is you know, I don't take joy in berating British brands, but oh my goodness, Black Star.
Uh-oh.
The JJN, Jared James Nichols amplifier. They took all of the good bits from their later HT upgrades.
Mm-hmm.
The HT series was...
They're the sort of modelling combos, are they?
No,
they were the wrong ones.
What they were, the HTs, about 2007 they came out. And at the time they were good. They were a really decent mid-range, sort of lower mid-range, first valve amp, go out and gig amps. Mm-hmm. And at the time, what Marshall were producing wasn't their most inspired time. And Black Star completely swiped the mid-range market. And they were great. You saw them in stages everywhere if you wanted that rock sound. The Mark II came along. And for this Jared James Nichols, they took all of the good bits of it and threw it away. And what you were left with was a amplifier that was so piercingly, horrifically bright, designed to work with his guitar, which is a really, really weird guitar. It's a P90 loaded Epiphone, which, not that there's anything wrong with that or his playing, but you know, he's obviously a very talented player, which is why they chose him. But that's the bit that annoys me, why they chose him. If you're going to give someone a signature guitar, that's enough of a congratulations on someone.
Yeah.
There must be a big player to get a guitar. To get someone interested in an amplifier, to get the GP, the general public, interested in an amplifier, you've got to be really special. Honestly, in the public discourse right now, the only people I think who could get away with a signature amplifier right now are possibly Slash.
I was actually going to say Slash. It's the only person that came to mind.
And then David Attenborough. Those are the only two big enough names I can think of that would get anyone interested in an amplifier. The fact that they went with Jared James Nichols, very fine blues player. Check out his stuff if that's what you're into. But he's not going to carry your brand at all. And they made the decision with Carmen Vanderberg. But that amp is actually really good. It's probably their best that they make, the CV30. But this JJN20 is just, it's hopeless. And it's not a particularly strong signature thing I get. I don't understand signature amplifiers. If you wanted to make a green HT, just make a green HT. It would be better than this and more people would be into it. right, I'm going to call my beans.
Are you feeling
a bit
better? Yeah,
that was...
off your chest. Has it been sitting there for a while?
Well, you mentioned it and it riled out of me. I just blew up like Yellowstone there. My apologies for covering your lovely recording tower in ash there, Pete. Oh, I don't know when these mics turn off.
Who knows? Weirdly, as somebody who never really uses guitar pedals, both of mine are guitar pedals.
I'm excited.
Yeah, okay. I like the modern metal. I do. It's nice. But there are a lot of signature overdrives that aren't really meant to add any like distortion. You know, the kinds like the Horizon Devices Precision Drive, which is probably the only one I'd accept. But there's loads of signature ones, which like, this is actually just a Tube Screamer with the gain off and the level all the way up. And they're all exactly the same. And there's loads of videos on YouTube comparing them all. And they all do the same thing. Just, they sound, just change the knob positions a little bit between them, but they all do the same.
I completely empathise with this,
yeah,
because it's the great con with those inverted commas drive pedals, because it's there for the market. You know, the one that immediately came to mind when you mentioned it, it's not one that's made anymore, is the MXR Berserker Overdrive Wild, which was exactly as you've mentioned. It's essentially a Dunlop-made Tube Screamer that's designed to go in between an EMG, EMG Gibson Les Paul and a Marshall.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're only going to achieve the sound because those are the two major parts of the instrument. The instrument's not the guitar. The instrument is the guitar interacting with that amp.
Mm.
And all the pedal is a little mediator. I'm glad you've brought this up because it is an absolute... It can be such a con.
Yeah.
Sticking someone's name on something and it's not, you know, selling it as the secret ingredient when it's completely out of context for such a large part of the market.
Totally. I mean, in the modern metal world, the idea is relatively high gain amp, put loads of volume into it, don't add gain because it makes the amp do some different things. And you can achieve it with basically any drive pedal. I mean, I'm sure there are arguments for drive pedals in other genres where there are characters to be had. But yeah, I don't know any specifics off the top of my head. I just remember there being so many. But on the good signature gear corner of the world, it's Chase Bliss, the Blooper, which was it's not quite a signature, it's a collaboration with Knobs.
I was going to say, who did they find mad enough to put their signature on that pedal?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's not, this is the only way to achieve my sound. If you want to be like me, then buy this pedal, buy my guitar, buy my amp, buy it now. Capitalism. Yeah, it was just, here's an interesting person who likes some cool things, and we like doing weird stuff too. It's interesting. Here it is.
Yeah, that would be the signature pedal of someone with schizophrenia. And yeah, the Blooper. It's the weird analog looper
one. It's the infinite loopery delay-ish thing.
Yes.
Yeah, the blue one. And then Mood is similar, but
with verb.
But verbier and pitchier.
Yes,
There's still
grain.
Some good pitch stuff.
It does grain on it,
yeah.
The Mood.
Yeah.
The reverb in that Mood is absolutely stunning.
I borrowed Joe's for a while.
Joe,
put some synth through it. It was brilliant.
Yeah, so good.
Anyway, signature gear rant over. I'm going to tell you about my week because, of course, that's definitely what you wanted to hear about. I went to see Evanescence on Tuesday. Blast from the past, that was. Got the tickets for free from a competition after we saw Genesis a good while back. And they were like VIP tickets in one of the boxes, private box, private bar, and all this at the Utilita Arena in Birmingham. It was actually quite an experience because, you know, you'll get to a really big venue like that and the queues are absolutely monstrous, filled with old goths. That's the demographic for Evanescence. And yeah, just waltzing past them and laughing as we walk upstairs to a gig that we didn't really want to go to, but it was free, so why not? And yeah, that was hilarious. I did enjoy it. But as you may well have experienced at any venue, sort of once you get beyond the first balcony kind of size of a, like, you've been to Coco in London?
Yes, yeah.
Bigger than that, and you know, you start getting problems, and then you get towards the kind of stadium size things and it all starts unraveling. The sound was shocking.
Right.
So we were, if you got the stage on one end and then kind of the back wall on the other, that sort of oval kind of shape, you could hear at equal volumes the sound from the stage and the echo off the kind of the back wall. So it was just the messiest thing. And being big enough, the delay is substantial. So the snare was sort of ba-ba all the time. And you couldn't hear any of the vocals.
Dotted eighth delay on every song.
Exactly. And this is, you know, there's big drums in these metal tunes. And it was all just mush. But it was a good view.
Well, that's why I go to gigs, is for the view.
Just for the view. Nothing else. Who cares what they're playing? Just stare at them, the whole thing.
Yeah, that's how you don't get let in again. yeah, that does disappoint me. The worst, obviously, this won't be the first time anyone's heard this. I always find the worst offender for that is the O2 in London.
Oh, it's really hard to get it to sound good, I think.
The only thing worth seeing in there is stand-up comedy and tennis.
Yeah.
It's really something.
I think the only way it works is if you can stand somewhere near where the sound people are. Because if you're on any of the walls, it's a nightmare.
Yeah.
This doesn't
or
happen.
If the PA rig is done by Martin Audio, there's more places you can stand.
I like that plug. Right, to the news! We have some modular stuff. Two new, interesting, synthesizery type somethings. Are they both on Kickstarter? Wow, there's a lot of Kickstarter this week.
Stop it. The audience can only take so much.
Oh my. No, one's Kickstarted, one is not. So, firstly, this is going to be really difficult to pronounce. Audio Anima Omega. Yeah, that's the one. So I guess the synth is called the Omega and the company is Audio Anima. So Audyo, new word, Anyma.
Don't even look at me. With
anyway,
the formulating
it's bizarre.
Letters.
But this is a physical modeling synthesizer. There's not a huge amount of those out. I think most of the ones you might expect would be old vintage stuff that faded into obscurity and is now loved by three people in the entire world.
When you say physical modeling, I'm expecting this to look exactly like Kate Moss.
Not at all, unfortunately. Much less exciting.
Okay.
Yeah, because let's face it, we are synth nerds here, so.
Right. Well, yeah. That's a subtitle that's writing checks I don't believe it can cash.
So, physical modelling is going to be when you use digital things, mostly it's going to be kind of code to...
Code's pretty digital.
It's very digital. Yeah, so to model strings, metal bars, and things being struck, plucked, bowed, etc. And there's loads of techniques for doing it, and it gets very mathsy and physicsy and confusing, but awesome things like mutable elements, rings. Actually, I can't think of many others. Pete, anything physical modelling coming to mind?
I would imagine the qubit surface.
Oh, yeah, good one. Ooh, and the engine that will be in the Osmos.
Yes.
As well.
Harkonnen.
Yes. Maybe we'll see one day. Anyway, there's another option for you. So this comes in keyboard flavours and module flavours. Let me give you some of the Beckaroonies, shall I, if I can find them. Okay, 16-voice polyphony, layering, split, and four parts of multi-timbrelishness, if you like it. You have three oscillator slots per voice with 30 different types, which actually includes VA and, I assume, wavetables and stuff. Five effects, including resonators and granular stuff, FM operators. Oh man, so in theory there's going to be a lot of power in this one. OLED screen, illuminated pads, lots of knobs, all sorts of things. But of course, it's a Kickstarter, so will we ever see it? I don't know. This isn't an established company kind of doing that pre-order thing. I think this is start this fresh project. So I don't know what we'll see. We have some stuff from SoundCloud. This will be with the Ribbon Expression Controller. Certainly sounds physical modelling to me. What about Resonator Landscape? Check out that rather nasty noise floor on that one. That's pretty horrifying. What do we got? Mellow Flute. Ooh. Maybe that's because it's a prototype. Well, if that's your thing, maybe check out the Kickstarter and play with your money wisely. Let's have a look at the funding tiers. They have a goal. Ooh, they've reached their goal already, which is £70,000. They've got £138,000 already. Wow, not bad.
So those noises were obviously someone's thing.
Is it a UK company?
I will see if I can find out. I don't actually know. Okay, we've got other parts to the name. So it's actually called the Anima Phi. Phi is in the Greek letter for some reason. Either way, pledge €498 or more, and that gets you the special edition, whatever that is.
Oh, it's a special.
Oh, no, that's something else entirely. I don't know what that is. What is the Anima Phi? Oh, that's the synth engine. Oh, maybe is that going to be a plugin? I've no idea. They're really not clear on this. But it'll be €840 or more. We'll get you the desktop 960 is the same thing. 1,155 for the version with a keyboard on it. That's very confusing, all of these tiers. We'll keep an eye on it. Slightly more weird is the next interesting keyboard we've got from Kodamo, who are the people who make the Essence FM, which is a rather interesting vintage FM chip, kind of dirty, grungy DX7 kind of vibe. But they've got a new synthesis method baked into a synthesizer. They call it bit mask synthesis. Now, let's see if we can actually find an explanation of what on earth that is.
Peter moves onto the edge of his seat.
Okay, here we go. Bear with me, guys. According to Kodamo, bitmask is a new synthesis method that splits a sine wave into many parts, which are then rearranged in different ways. You can create classic waveforms with it, like saw, but also crazy new timbres. They sound grittier and dirtier than traditional oscillators, say the developers. Interesting. So it sounds like kind of a wavetable, but with kind of harsh slices in between each stage, so it just sounds angry. Who knows? It's quite an interesting looking keyboard that they're using to demo this one, with just a bunch of kind of clacky buttons and not much encoderage over here. And because it's a strange synthesis method, a lot of the a lot of the kind of use of it seems a little obscure.
Sometimes are quite like that in terms of if something's new, having option paralysis with something quite open and new. Maybe I'm sat on a manufacturer's side, but it can be a bit easier to get to the point of your product if you limit the doors to open.
Definitely. Especially, imagine giving somebody a DX7 or like a Kawai K1, these horribly dense digital instruments that have one fader and a few buttons to program all your sounds. They go, here you are, you can make whatever sound you want with it. Or then you could give them like a MicroKorg. It'd be those two options, wouldn't it? Just not much to change, lots of obvious effects, or I don't even know what this parameter is doing right now.
Yeah, that's it. And you might spend a bit more time fiddling than playing. But maybe there are definitely people who prefer fiddling than playing.
Definitely.
I know many of them.
Right, let's see if we can get some sound on this one. Found anything in the documentation about filters, so it'll be interesting to see what control you have over harmonic content. But there we are, that is the Kodamo Mask 1.
I did quite like that. There was some nice abrasiveness to the tone of that. It didn't just feel like it was being squeezed through an op-amp with some small old diode.
A little bit retro in feel as well, but not entirely. This is obviously trying to be that one thing from that one time.
No, that's it. It felt like there was a bit more almost vibrato in closed cans anyway. That was interesting.
So two oscillators with 200 built-in waveforms, noise generator. Aha, there is actually a filter in here. 12 state variable filter, but it is digital. Interesting. We'll see where they go with this. I think they have like a one voice version of it that they're using to kind of develop the synthesis technology as well.
How impressed were you with the samples presented?
Sounded very FM synthesis-y. Yeah, they're a bit meh.
Fair enough.
Most synth kind of sounds, I think, to an extent, have been made at this point.
Yeah, that's how wavy can a wave get?
Exactly.
Waveception attempted.
One more bit of synth news, I think, this week. Oh no, it's another really difficult one to pronounce. So the manufacturer is...
I believe in you, Ben.
Blukash. Blukas, I've no idea. I don't know where they're from, so I have nothing to base my terrible attempt on. Blukac with a little upside down hat on it. Looks like the C's got two little ears.
That's a good looking C.
Yeah, I got no idea. Either way, it's called the Endless Processor. Now, how do you describe what it does? I don't know. It's got a couple of inputs, a couple of channels, and what it'll do is infinitize whatever you put into it. So it's got a little yellow button on it with a little infinity symbol, and I assume it captures kind of a little loop of audio in some way to just sustain your sounds forevermore.
It's just like a freeze on a reverb or something like that.
Yeah, but instead of, because I guess with a reverb you've added to the original signal before sustaining it. This is just using the original signal to keep it going. I don't think there's any extra synthesis, resynthesis to keep it going. It's just manipulating the original audio that it captures. You don't then have pitch control over it, which is annoying because it would be nice to be able to then play that in some way. Because, I mean, you can do that with lots of other technologies, like you still on Ableton, of course. Sample something, repitch it. It's still kind of interesting. Not a huge production. At the moment, the way to get hold of them seems to be message the guy on Modwiggler, and that's kind of it. Email him, send him some cash, and hope you end up with a module at the end.
I won't be doing that.
No. It's interesting. I really want to wait for more sound examples.
Will you be sending him crypto instead, Pete?
Yeah. Keep yourself safe. Here we go. There are some sound samples here. So that's kind of sending a really simple synth pulse into it and then just clicking the hold button while it's going.
That just sounded annoying.
Let's see if their second sound example can impress Pete.
Could be a similar review for most of the listeners on this particular episode. My apologies.
Let's give them a second chance. Is a piano chord being sustained there.
You know what it reminds me of? When you're working on some audio and your PC crashes.
Yeah, or I've put my... I've put my plate down on the desk and it's just caught one of the keys on my on my controller. And I was like, what is that bloody noise? Oh, I've put my cheese and crackers plate and it's just caught one of the keys.
Exactly.
The thing with that audio clip is the second one, I really wanted to not be able to expect where it was going, and I knew where it was going. Yeah. And I was right.
The thing is, all you've got control of is volume.
So more or less annoying.
Yeah, pretty much. I guess you got to feed it good stuff and hope for the best.
Just like children.
Why? Why have they even bothered?
Who knows? Maybe there'll be a bigger and better version at some point that can actually, you know, change the sound in some way, like swirl it around, make it interesting and make a pad out of anything, but, you know, get a fancy reverb or something.
It's not like is there a rival podcast that might have made that whole brand up just to try and get you to say the name of it?
Who knows? Well, I couldn't. I don't know. I couldn't pronounce
the
brand
name. The whole ruse.
They just wanted me to embarrass myself. Anyway, there's the end of the synth news. You know what that means. Anyway, it is the miscellaneous multimedia recommendation time for all of us. I have mine ready to go, so I'm going to do it first. Yes, lovely. I've mentioned the band Low Island before. If you like slightly synthy, kind of lo-fi punchy drums and fun things like that. They have a new album out called Life in Miniature, but I shall direct you to a song called Robin. Yeah, that's it. Robin by Low Island from the album Life in Miniature. And I can't play it on the podcast because of copyright reasons and all that kind of fun stuff. Ollie, are you ready? What have you got?
I am ready. I'm ready to, unfortunately, bring this wonderful world of synthesis and modular glory to the knuckle draggers world of football. There's going to be a small tournament going on that's causing some sort of controversy you may have heard of. My media this week is a YouTube channel. Now, I understand talking about sport on a synthesizers podcast.
We have spoken about squash and cycling at length before, so I think you're safe with other sports.
I love Robinson Squash and Neil Armstrong. Those are great guys. But no, this is a YouTube channel that I think brings a little bit of class to the whole thing of football.
Is that possible?
It is. Wow. It is, because the thing with football is, yes, it's a really accessible game, and that's half the reason we love it, the amount of passion that drives it. And, you know, it's watched by everyone, and no one's going to think that they're too good for it. It can suck you in so easily, and it does. At its best, it is wonderful, heartwarming and entertaining. But obviously, it's not without its detractors, and some of those detractors put a lot of people off the sport, which I understand. And a part of that, if I'm honest, is the ridiculous media circus around football that just, you know, precipitates all of this this carnival about 22 blokes kicking a ball around, which I completely take as the main retort to being interested in football. But there is a YouTube channel called Tifo Football, which I can't recommend enough. Now, if you do enjoy football, but perhaps are a little bit embarrassed about your mate Keith, who likes football as well, and perhaps a little bit too much to the... so that he's a bit embarrassing to be around in the pub. This is a great, great YouTube channel called Tifo, who talk about it sensibly, without the furor of player personality or the warped lens of club affiliation. And the reason I bring them up on this particular week is they have done a fantastic 4-part mini documentary. Each video is only 15 minutes long. A fantastic animated and narrated 4-part documentary that's essentially chronicled what's led us to a World Cup in Qatar. Because a lot of people may wonder how we got here. And it's very, very interesting. And I think it just throws a nice lens on it, because it's by no means the perfect place to hold a football tournament. There are many places we can say aren't the perfect place, and that doesn't make it okay to hold a football tournament there. But they show a fantastic amount of research and integrity in what they do. And they've really shined a really good light on this tournament. And it might not change your opinion on it, but I think it reframes why we have the certain opinions we have. That is Tifo, T-I-F-O, YouTube channel. They also have a YouTube channel which isn't animated, called Tifo IRL, if you like them that much. But give those 4 videos a go. They're only 15 minutes long, and it might give a nice bit of context to the layman as to why there is so much furor about a World Cup in the Middle East.
What was the title of the documentary?
The documentary, I think it's the most recent one. It's just The Qatar World Cup Explained, episodes 1, 2, 3, and 4.
No way.
I know. It's amazing. And yeah, they're fantastic. Really well animated, beautifully narrated. And as I said, really good. It's heartening to see good journalism. I think that's what it is, especially in a sport like football, which, you know, such a low bar can pass for entertainment these days. And those guys do a lot of really good work. And I can't recommend them enough.
Great stuff. Pete, can you parcel this one up for us?
I certainly can. Now, I'm coming to the realisation that the whole world and every facet of it, within reason,
is a complete and total disaster. Yes, go on.
It can be found on YouTube.
Oh, right, right.
And the particular channel that surfaced in my video stream in the last weeks was certainly different. It's entitled Radioactive Drew.
Okay.
And the premise of it is a gentleman who I assume his name is Drew. In fact, his name is Drew, as it says, my name is Drew.
Spoiler alert.
He goes to all sorts of radioactive places with his Geiger counter.
Oh, yeah.
Catching illnesses and growing body parts.
Well, generally he insists that it's, if you know what you're doing, it's not as dangerous as you might suspect.
Right.
The particular first video that I watched, he went to the Trinity site.
I don't know what that is.
Trinity site was where the first atomic bomb was exploded, and the US government stroke military, whoever controls it, opens it to the public twice a year.
Interesting.
So you can go there and you can literally stand on the exact spot where it was detonated, and then there's remnants of things that were vaporized.
Wow.
In the course of the explosion, there's also a mock-up of the actual bomb itself. And then a few miles away, they sort of drive you in a bus and you go to its homestead that they took over. And that's where they assembled the bomb and put all the bits together before they trucked it out to the Trinity site itself. So that was kind of interesting on this sort of historical nature.
And I bet that was a nervous driver driving that Chevy truck across them.
Well, they all seemed quite relaxed because they had the whole place is covered in that atomic glass, trinitite.
Never heard
so
of
it. So it's a green glass that was produced by the intense heat because it's
just
a desert. It's basically
rock.
A desert. Wow. So all the sand has turned to glass. And there's great slabs of it all around the place. You're not allowed to pick it. It's an offence to take it, you know, pocket any of it
it's
and take
like,
it with you.
It was so hot it made the earth a creme brulee.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
But, and he's going round, sort of, he's got his little Geiger counter and he's sort of measuring it and that sort of thing and prodding it around. But it's not as radioactive as you suspect. And because the half-life of the type of fission they were using isn't as bad as some other stuff, and he explains the difference between different types of radioactivity and the ones that are, they could be really high in radioactivity but you can't ingest it because it's sealed in something. He went to a house somewhere in California and it's got all these marvelously bright and exotic tiles everywhere, on the outside, on the inside, everywhere, and they're all radioactive because they use
the paint dyes and things.
Yeah, the dyes or the colouring for the glazes is highly radioactive, right. And it's seriously radioactive, you know, thousands of times above background radiation. But he states it's safe because it's all sealed in the glaze. And he goes to uranium mines, he goes to decommissioned nuclear power stations and that type of thing. I just thought it was...
Just followed everywhere by Imagine Dragons, is
he? That sort of thing.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
No, I was there to get it for you. It's
thank you very much.
I just thought it was different. So
certainly.
That is my multimedia recommendation for this week, the YouTube channel Radioactive Drew.
I bet he is by now. I'm going straight there.
See if he's got three arms like Zaphod Beeblebrox or something. Weird stuff. Thank you, as always, for tuning in to this strange corner of the internet. We do hope you return for the 150th episode. Oh, man, how long have we been doing this now, Pete?
3 years.
3 years.
I don't think I've been here that long talking.
Good night.